Iambic Audiobooks presents The Autobiography of Jenny X by Lisa Dierbeck, read by Darla Middlebrook. Part 1. Nadia and Dan. Chapter 1. The Accusation. "Nadia, are you cheating on me?" Dan asked on a Saturday night. Wearing only his wristwatch and his underwear, he perched on the edge of the sofa in their hotel suite. He spoke dispassionately, as if wondering whether Nadia had borrowed his umbrella without asking him. "What are you talking about?" Nadia plucked at the sash of her robe. In one hand, she clasped a compact, decorated with inlaid mother-of-pearl and onyx. She stared down at the black-and-white design framing her reflection. Her face was flushed. Inside the small mirror, her mouth had formed an O. "You heard what I said. I asked you a question. Are you seeing someone else?" Listening to his voice, one would never guess that he might be angry or upset. This was a useful skill for delivering bad news to the dying, Nadia supposed. Dan had learned his neutral, uninflected tone in medical school. "Of course not." She clicked the compact close. "Sure about that, Nadia? Or do you need some time to think about it?" He was leaning down, clipping his toenails, his feet planted firmly on the June issue of American Oncology. The sound of his stainless steel nail clippers rose in volume, an irregular snip-snap, snap-snip, loud and grating. All other noises, she noticed, were gradually disappearing. Nadia slipped a fingernail between the teeth of her comb. She ran the ball of her index finger along the thin strips of plastic, playing them like strings on a harp. She discerned the faint hum of a musical chord. "You stood me up," Dan said. "We waited for you for hours. You didn't bother to call me. You never offered an explanation. You just expected me to put up with your vanishing." "Do we have to go over it and over it?" said Nadia, though they'd never spoken about what had happened. "That was weeks ago." She heard irritability in her voice, self-righteousness in her claim to fidelity. "I was worried about you. I still am." Nadia considered this anxiously. Her palms were damp as they'd been last Sunday afternoon when she tried to help her son with his eighth-grade chemistry take-home exam. The correct answer came to her, but she couldn't speak. For some reason, she couldn't articulate the simple, necessary statement, "I'm sorry." She'd been dumb enough to think that that evening had been quietly forgotten. Instead, it seemed Dan had been studying Nadia for 2 months now, like a difficult math equation. She squeezed a tube of makeup and began to daub drops of glittering white liquid in the hollows of her eyes. "Radiance," it said, in gold letters on the side of the tube. The cream promised to eliminate wrinkles and dark circles. One segment of Nadia's mind gave attentive study to her cosmetics application. The rest of her thoughts fled in alarm to Christopher Benedict, the senator's son. He lived in a 6-by-9-foot cement cell in Triton, New York, just 2 hours away from the Canadian border. There were 3 categories of federal penitentiary, Nadia had learned. Christopher's was Supermax. Though this sounded to Nadia like a brand of feminine protection, it meant that he was confined behind bars 23 hours a day with the highest degree of security and the largest number of guards in solitary confinement. Dan reached over to the bedside table and opened a bottle of mineral water. With infuriating poise, he poured himself a glassful. "You frightened us. I almost called the police." "What about the hours you keep? You fall asleep on the couch in your office and don't get home till dawn."
"The only times I've done that," said Dan gravely, "have been medical emergencies." Medical, in Dan's mouth, sounded like the Virgin Mother. It was, for Dan, a holy word.
"You've got a double standard," said Nadia. "Do you know how many times I wake up in the middle of the night wondering where you are?
I work in a hospital. What the hell is your excuse?" Even hell sounded respectful when it came from Dan. She'd often thought that nothing was real to him except for his cancer cells. Dan could probably tolerate a straying wife. What threw him into a rage was the mulishness of other oncologists who resisted his innovations, and other physicians' incompetence. If she were to say now, "Yes, I've had an extramarital affair," he'd probably just take out his laboratory notebook and start taking notes. But Nadja was more complicated than that. She'd deceived him so thoroughly he'd never forgive her for it. It was imperative that he never find out. "I'm waiting, Nadja. Are you going to tell me?" Nadja tossed her comb down on the vanity. "It's all so simple for you, isn't it? You talk to me like you're the head of everything running your department. You want to reduce error and improve efficiency, do you? Well, this is a marriage, not a hospital, and I'm not one of your brown-nosing lab assistants." She stopped. Her comb had ricocheted off the wall, landing in a tray of mints, displacing one. The piece of candy had collided against the ashtray before coming to rest beside a matchbox. It was embossed with the words, "The Parallel Club, Berlin, London, Moscow, Munich, New York, Paris, Rome." "You make it difficult at this point," said Dan. Nadja blinked, her eyes stung. She reached out for the curtains. Her hands became enmeshed in layers of sheer fabric before she was able to make contact with the window. It got stuck when she pushed it open. She shoved. It wouldn't budge. She brought her forehead close, resting against the cool glass pane. The sidewalk lay smooth and flat below. Across the street from their hotel, the grounds of the Carnegie Mansion were abloom with roses, lit up by lights, kept behind iron gates. Nadja heard a clarinet playing and the clatter of dishes being cleared away. They'd missed the cocktail hour. The auction for mercy was about to begin in the ground floor ballroom. They'd have to attend. It was expected of them. Dan would never break down, lose his head, crumble. A driven, competitive man, he'd excelled in three careers at once, as a research scientist, an oncologist, and a surgeon. Dan kept calm under pressure. It was this trait of level-headed rationality which had drawn Nadja to him. Dan, people said, was the kind of rock-like man one ought to stand next to in a fire. That was just what Nadja had done when she'd been in trouble once. She'd singled him out for his kindness, his reliability, and his sense of perspective. And then she'd pursued Dan tirelessly. But there was something else in him, withdrawn and passive. Nadja had become attuned to it. Now, as she watched him adjust his shirt cuffs just so, he seemed indifferent. "It was your birthday." "I'd made that reservation months in advance," Dan said, reviewing the events of that terrible day in April when Nadja had almost gotten caught. "Nadja, please. All I ever do is try to... Nadja sat bolt upright in her chair. In all their years of marriage, she'd only once seen him weep. But the moment passed. It had just lasted an instant. Dan inserted a cufflink through the buttonhole of his sleeve. He started tucking the tails of his white smocked shirt into his freshly pressed tuxedo pants. "I've spent my life," he said and didn't conclude the thought. He had not spent his life trying to make Nadja happy. She'd never been at the center. He expended his best energies on ministering to the ill, the phantoms, wrestling them from death, restoring them, nursing them along, playing savior to them. His patients were his damsels in distress. Cancer was his enemy. The drama that absorbed him had left Nadja on the periphery. Nadja's breathing slowed and she felt immobile, helpless, like an unconscious body laid out on an operating table. A breeze blew across her face, but she still wasn't getting enough air. She wondered if he could hear her stealthily gasping for breath. She imagined her lungs as a pair of butterfly wings. They seemed not to be functioning. "I'd really like to understand you, Nadja," said Dan. "Nadja Tantarina Larina." He spoke slowly, thoughtfully, as if recalling the name of an old college roommate. "Nadja Larina, the woman who forgot her own birthday." Nadja exhaled through her nostrils and kept on doing this, concentrating only on the exhalation. She ran a brush through her hair and stole a glance at Dan. She wondered if anything real belonged to her. Her husband's face gave away nothing. Round-cheeked and olive-skinned, he had the disorderly hair of an orchestra conductor. His thick eyebrows and black beard gave him a ferocious, even sinister appearance. He rarely lost his cool, however, thanks to his training. Dan was a disciplined and honorable man. He kept his equilibrium by holding his feelings in check. Dan pulled a sock up over the shapely, petite calves that had never seemed sturdy enough to support all 200 pounds of him. It was a black dress sock with silver stitching at the toe. The specific appearance of this sock took on an ominous intensity, a hidden significance, in the manner of observations made for the last time. In January, Nadia had ordered 10 pairs of these socks. It was the day that Dan and the kids had gone snowboarding in the Catskills while Nadia had holed up in the attic. She'd listened to Madama Butterfly while Blondie had snorted at her feet, chewing a rubber toy shaped like a pretzel, holding her paw over it to keep it firmly in place, making it squeak and whistle, lending a comedic syncopated rhythm to Puccini's opera. Nadia could recall every detail of that leisurely Sunday afternoon, which had been unremarkable to her at the time. The gray ribbon of the river had wound past the hill outside her window, while her fountain pen had scratched across the catalog order form. The space heater that warmed Nadia's legs had hummed in its corner. Blondie had growled, hearing an intruder, a black squirrel that had jumped on the roof from the oak tree and had scrambled towards their chimney. Nadia had glanced up to see the photograph she'd taken of Christopher. It made her hold her breath, as if the senator's son wasn't a prison inmate, but a protean being, a shaman who could inhabit the leaves, the squirrel, the sky, the photograph as he wished, occupying Nadia's thoughts, making a miraculous surprise appearance, a visitation. She'd been transfixed by the angular face, the arrogant expression, the intent black eyes that took in more than they gave away. When she'd taken that photograph of Christopher, she'd opened the aperture too wide, let the film become overexposed. But she'd caught the glint of mischief in his gaze. As the leader of the Bond Street Actionist, he'd modeled his group after a band of Viennese artists. Christopher believed in breaking the law. Dan was using a shoehorn to wedge his foot into his stiff black leather Oxford. "Did you know? The other physicians at Mercy are under the delusion I'm intelligent. They say it's just a matter of time before I get the prize." He glanced up at her, neutral, with that clear scientific vision that judged nothing, that missed nothing. Here was a fleeting chance for reconciliation, Nadia's cue to proclaim, "Yes, Dan, you deserve the Nobel Prize in Medicine." Every year, Dan's colleagues placed bets on scientists like gamblers at a racetrack. Dan, though hidden away in an unprepossessing hospital, was favored to win. Even on their first date, he'd told her, "Before I'm 50, I'm going to win a Nobel." Nadia had been shocked by his egotism, but had soon learned that such talk was typical for scientists whose progress was concrete, dramatic, and measurable. Diseases were eliminated, vaccines invented. People lived because of Dan's breakthroughs instead of dying. But Nadia had missed her cue, and instead of praising her husband in the interest of peace, she kept silent. "I treat patients who haven't got a prayer," he said, dusting off his credentials as if Nadia needed reminding. "They came to me because they were written off everywhere else. Every other oncologist in the U.S. gives up on these cases as hopeless. Only I know." She cut him off impatiently. She didn't like herself for it, but she was jealous of Dan's patience, the time and devotion he lavished upon them. She was envious of Dan's reputation as a pioneer, a maverick, who made daring medical advances. It galled Nadia that Dan couldn't confront her honestly tonight without hauling out his accolades, his medals of honor for medical heroism. They had, at some early point in their marriage, begun to engage in a contest. Who was the most significant player in the wider universe? But now, having given up her gig with National Geographic to stay close to home for the kids, Nadia had lost. She was a respected photographer, but she wasn't curing anyone of terminal illness. She'd stopped making her annual pilgrimage to the Amazon, so she couldn't credit herself with trying to save the rainforest. Her photos of monkeys and tree frogs no longer appeared on magazine covers. "I wonder," Dan said, "if we even know each other. We've had three kids together. Nadja twisted a strand of her hair and plunged a hairpin through it. The metal scraped her scalp. We have. He gazed into her eyes, steady, searching. I don't know what you're asking. Tell me who he is. The man on your wall. He's everywhere. You plastered his face all over Red Barn. Red Barn is private. You promised me that. Nadja, you've been painting his portrait since we moved in. Ever since we bought our place in Riverbend. We didn't buy anything, Nadja snapped unpleasantly. I bought the house, not you. When I met you, she began, and then regretted it. How clumsy. She had actually been going to say, when I met you, you had nothing. You've got his portrait around so you can look at him. Is he your boyfriend? You're not allowed inside my studio, Dan. That's the rule. You spied on me. God only knows what you do in there all day. He was unpacking his suitcase. He took out his leather travel case and his neatly folded undershirts and set them down on the bedspread, digging deeper into the bag. I hope it's painting, Nadja. Honestly. She turned her back on him so he couldn't see her face. She made a grab for the notepad on the desk simply because she needed something to occupy her hands. The thin raised letters at the top of the paper spelled out 1050 Fifth Avenue. Senator Benedict had owned a condominium less than 10 blocks away from this building. Nadja had been inside the Parallel Club more than once before. Nadja. He removed a large padded envelope from his suitcase. As soon as Nadja saw it, she knew. Dan crossed the room with a determined gait and placed the package on the vanity in front of her. It was addressed in scrawling green capital letters, to Jenny X. In a much neater hand, in crisp black script, someone had written, care of Mrs. Nadja Lorena Orsini. The upper left-hand corner of the package wasn't handwritten, but printed, and the return address was U.S. Penitentiary, U.S.P. Triton, P.O. Box 300, Triton, New York, 18472. I've been intercepting these letters for weeks, said Dan. You intercepted letters? The words had lost their meaning. They're intended for a fugitive with no last name. A woman you've been in contact with. Nadja bit the inside of her cheeks to keep her face from revealing what she felt. When I found the first letter, I marked it, no such address, please return. And then one day, Nadja, one day when I came home early and you weren't there, I opened one. In the center of the envelope was a mysterious bump. Nadja withdrew her hand fast, as if the package from prison might explode.